Chapter 2. To Commission a Commission. Our Constitution is not merely a formal document regulating public power. It also embodies, like the German Constitution, an objective normative value system. It is within this matrix that the common law must be developed. Justices Laurie Ackerman and Richard Goldstone in the South African Constitutional Court. My time at the Centre for Constitutional Rights ended at the end of 2008. My work there had always been part-time, initially for 2.5 days a week and later for 3 days a week. I was able to pursue other interests in my own time and did so. During and after December 2008, my major preoccupation was to plan the case aimed at compelling the National President to appoint a commission of inquiry into the arms deals. At this point, I think it would be helpful to describe the purpose of commissions of inquiry and the processes involved in their appointment in terms of the South African law. According to the editors of LAWSA, the encyclopedic authority on South African law, the word commission has two distinct meanings in the context of an inquiry. First, it refers to an authoritative charge or direction to act in a prescribed manner. Second, it also refers to the body that carries out the charge or direction. In modern South African law, there are four kinds of commission: executive, constitutional, statutory, and common law commissions. Terry Crawford Brown and the Social Justice Commission would try to compel the president, who had the power to do so in terms of the constitution, to appoint an executive commission of inquiry into the arms deals. This constitutional power is derived from the prerogative of the sovereign in the pre-constitutional political order. An executive commission is an instrument of policy making for the benefit of the national executive. It is required to determine facts and to make recommendations to the president as the head of the executive. Neither the President nor anyone else is bound by the findings of fact or the recommendations of any commission. Although commissions are often presided over by judges, they are administrative in nature. The underlying idea is that a person as busy as the President, who is both the head of state and also head of the national executive, does not have the time to delve into a complex factual matrix in order to determine the truth and make recommendations or even policy based upon the facts so determined. A good example is the Marikana Commission of Inquiry, presided over by the retired Appeal Court Judge Ian Farlam, who was tasked with investigating events at the Lonmin Platinum Mine at Marikana in Northwest Province in August 2012, which had resulted in the deaths of 44 people. This inquiry involved reams of evidence, the cross-examination of witnesses, and consideration of a great deal of expert opinion on the events that had unfolded during an unprotected strike by rock drillers in search of better wages and living conditions. Clearly, no president could sit through the hearing of evidence and then sift through the material placed before the Farlam Commission as the inquiry became known. The process for appointing commissions is regulated in part by the Commissions Act of 1947. Procedures adopted by the Commission must also comply with the provisions of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act of 2000. The first question that had to be considered in preparing the case that Terry was prepared to launch was the nature of the relief to be claimed in the matter. While many lawyers would have plumped for a review of the presidential decision to refuse the request by the Social Justice Coalition and the four prominent citizens, we decided that an order compelling the president to appoint a commission, or an order directing him to reconsider the refusal of the request, would be a more streamlined approach. We bore in mind that Motlanthe was a bench warmer, or temporary president, who would be replaced by the president of the ANC in the likely event of the ANC winning the general elections to be held in May 2009. This would mean that by the time the matter came to court, a different president, probably Jacob Zuma, would be in office. This created all sorts of complications for the intended litigation, notably that Zuma's former financial advisor, one Shabir Sheikh, had been convicted in 2005 of corrupting Zuma, inter alia, in relation to the arms deals. In the course of that case, it was proven beyond reasonable doubt that a South African subsidiary of the French arms and electronics manufacturer Thomson, later known as Tint, which had provided the combat suites for the Navy corvettes, had paid Zuma 500,000 rand a year. These payments were made to encourage Zuma to use his position as deputy president and leader of government business in parliament to protect Thomson against investigations of the arms deal bidding process and helping it to secure further government contracts. While Sheikh's conviction did not bind or directly affect Zuma, it would place him in a rather awkward position. Then there was the question of which court to approach for the relief which we would decide to seek. One option was a direct approach to the Constitutional Court, the highest court in the land. At that time, the learning in law on the topic of direct approaches to this court, which has a distinct preference for sitting as a court of final appeal rather than a court of first instance, was complicated, opaque, and contradictory. We approached learned professors in this field for their advice. Both Pierre de Vos at the University of Cape Town and George Devenish at the University of KwaZulu-Natal advised us not to approach the Constitutional Court directly. That left Terry with the choice between the High Courts in Pretoria and Cape Town. The former is the administrative capital of the country, and the latter the legislative capital. This arrangement had begun with the Union of South Africa in 1910 and did not change with the advent of a constitutional democracy in 1994. As he lives in Cape Town, Terry was content to sue in the High Court there simply as a matter of convenience and because the president had a suitable address for service, namely De Tain House, his official Cape Town residence, which is situated in the gardens right next to Parliament. Next, it was necessary to decide whether to proceed by way of action or application. An action is the better legal route in matters of this nature when it is apparent that disputes of fact may arise. An application is usually decided on the respondent's version of events, taken together with whatever is not disputed in the applicant's founding papers. Given that the arms deal cover-up was already a thriving cottage industry among organs of state and politicians, we expected some of Terry's factual allegations to be hotly disputed. This meant that we would need to proceed by way of an action, in which evidence could be led and tested under cross-examination. There was another good reason to proceed by way of action. Publicly available information suggested strongly that at least some of the bribes paid by arms manufacturers in order to secure the contracts were used to pay for the ANC's 99 election campaign and strengthen its coffers in general. We thought this could be confirmed by serving the ANC Treasurer General with a subpoena ordering him to bring its financial records to court so that its donors could be identified and compared with the individuals and organizations implicated in the skullduggery swirling around the arms deals. In this way, the malfeasance could be established via a paper trail rather than the arduous business of cross-examining witnesses in the course of a trial. So the business of preparing particulars of claim for issue out of the Western Cape High Court began in earnest once the advice of the professors and the tactical considerations had been carefully weighed. We decided on a bare-bones type of pleading so as to make it as difficult as possible for the president to deal with the meat of the case in the course of his written response. It is never good practice to plead evidence. After much drafting and redrafting, in which my junior in the case, Peter Hazel, SC, played an enthusiastic role, the core of the claim took the following form. I cite this at some length, as it provides a useful summary of the arms deal and the subsequent allegations of corruption. On about the 3rd of December 1999, the South African government signed a set of contracts in terms of which it agreed to buy 3 submarines from the German Submarine Consortium, 4 frigates from the German Frigate Consortium, 30 utility helicopters from Augusta, 24 Hawk trainer aircraft from British Aerospace, and 28 Saab Gripen Jazz 39 fighter aircraft from BAE Saab. One or more or all of these contracts were tainted by fraud, corruption, or other irregularities which justified the cancellation of the contracts and the recovery of all amounts paid. This assessment was based on a range of facts and allegations which were already publicly known. These included information contained in 3 books about the arms deals written by Terry Crawford Brown, by Andrew Feinstein, and by Paul Holden. The conviction of former ANC Chief Whip Tony Yangeni on charges of fraud arising from the fact that he'd bought a Mercedes-Benz sports utility vehicle at a discount arranged by one of the subcontractors to an arms dealer. The conviction in the Durban High Court of Shabir Sheikh, former financial advisor to Jacob Zuma, and 10 companies under his control on charges of fraud and corruption relating to payments made to Zuma in which arms deal interests were implicated. Charges then pending against Zuma relating to his acceptance of money from Tint, a company involved in one of the arms deals, allegedly in return for protecting it against investigation. Zuma's oral threat made in March 2008 that if he was convicted on those charges, he would expose others. Judge Chris Nicholson's recommendation that a commission of inquiry into the arms deal be appointed, made in the course of his judgment in the case between Zuma and the National Prosecuting Authority in the KwaZulu-Natal High Court on the 12th of September 2008. Criminal proceedings against and investigations of various individuals and companies in respect of alleged bribery and corruption related to the South African arms deals in foreign jurisdictions. The findings of a joint investigating team comprising the Public Protector, the Auditor General, and the National Director of Public Prosecutions in a report dated the 14th of November 2001 that raised suspicions of misfeasance and malfeasance in respect of the arms deals. The results of an investigation into the arms deals conducted by the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Public Accounts, which is known as SCOPA, which did likewise, and the dossier about the arms deals tabled in Parliament by Patricia de Lille, a Member of Parliament, on the 9th of September 1999. Second, we argued that the arms deals were economically and legally irrational. Initially, the government had stated it would spend 30.3 billion in return for offset deals worth 104 billion rand, which would include creating 65,000 jobs. However, the costs of the arms deals had increased from 30.3 billion rand to more than 50 billion rand, despite the fact that in August 1999, an affordability team reporting to the Minister's Committee on the Affordability of the Defence Strategic Armaments Packages had recommended that expenditure should not exceed 16.5 billion rand, and that the benefits related to the acquisitions were not nearly as certain as their costs. As anticipated by the affordability team, all or most of the offset deals, including the 65,000 jobs, had not materialized. As a result, we argued, the costs of the arms deals far outweighed current or any future benefits. There was no current or future threat to national security against which the purchased arms could possibly be used. Moreover, the arms bought were either useless or underutilized. Third, we argued that the arms deals contravened the Constitution in that the procurement process was not fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, or cost-effective, and should therefore be set aside. Additional points made included the stated cost of 30.3 billion rand did not include the costs of loan finance, appropriate provision for currency exchange rate fluctuations, and appropriate provision for the effects of inflation. In November 2008, some of the assets of Fana Shlongwane, an advisor to the then Minister of Defence, the late Joe Madisi, were frozen by court orders due to his involvement in corrupt dealings and illegal commissions. In August 2008, the Sunday Times reported that former President Thabo Mbeki had received a bribe of 30 million rand, of which he had passed on 28 million rand to the ANC and 2 million rand to Zuma. Despite being quick to do so in other instances, neither Mbeki nor Zuma instituted defamation or any other proceedings in respect of these allegations. In 2008, the ANC embarked on its own fact-gathering exercise about the arms deals, ostensibly to inform its post-Polokwane leadership. The findings of this exercise were never made public. In a report released in January 2009, the Independent Panel Assessment of Parliament stated that Parliament should continue to exercise oversight over the arms deals and take whatever steps it deemed necessary to pursue this matter, including debating a resolution calling for the appointment of a judicial commission of inquiry. On the 16th of January 2009, the SCOPA chairman, Themba Gordhi, complained publicly that the attempts of his committee to obtain information about the arms deals from government, departments, arms corps, and the National Prosecuting Authority had been rebuffed. Gordhi threatened to summons the National Prosecuting Authority, Arms Corps, and the Department of Trade and Industry to appear before his committee, declaring, "If they can't write, perhaps they can talk." On 20th August 2008, the plaintiff, Terry Crawford Brown, laid criminal complaints concerning perjury in the cover-up of impropriety in the arms deals. These claims related to statements made under oath by Trevor Manuel, Minister of Finance at the time of the arms deals, and Maria Ramos, then Director General of the National Treasury, who later became Manuel's wife. In the earlier litigation aimed at cancelling the loans that underpinned the arms deals. In a letter dated 28th March 2008, a businessman, Richard Young, asked the NPA to investigate corruption in respect of the arms deals. He claimed his company was a victim. Subsequent to his letter, the government paid Young's company, CCII, a settlement of 15 million rand. In a letter dated the 26th of January 2007, Economists Allied for Arms Reduction South Africa, chaired by Terry Crawford Brown, drew the attention of the public protector to alleged wrongdoing in the arms deals. Despite these requests and initiatives, no discernible progress had been made in investigating these issues. In formulating our allegations, we tried to prevent legal point-taking, as well as the taking of exceptions. The latter procedure allows defendants to object to a document submitted by claimants on the grounds that they are vague and embarrassing, in the quaint terminology of the rules of court, or do not disclose a cause of action. Claimants either have to amend the documents in question or face dismissal of their claims. As can be expected, the exception route is often taken by litigants who are reluctant to deal with the merits of the claim. But our efforts to avoid this came to naught. The President's legal team took exception after exception with a view to stringing out the case in the apparent hope that Terry would either lose interest or die before the case got to court. But Terry is made of sterner stuff than that. So we dealt with the technical point taking as best we could, with a view to bringing the matter to a head sooner rather than later. Eventually, after much paper skirmishing, the President's legal team, then led by Marumo Murani, ran out of vague and embarrassing points and filed a more substantive exception to the effect that the matter should be heard in the Constitutional Court rather than the High Court. While this contradicted the advice we'd received from the two learned professors, we took a tactical decision to concede the point and take Terry's complaint to the highest court, which the President seemed to prefer. Any other route would have involved lengthy technical wrangling, which is exactly what the President wanted and Terry wanted to avoid. The parties could not agree on who should bear the costs of the High Court action thus far. The matter was allocated to Acting Judge Nonkosi Saba, who had been elevated to this temporary position from the Magistrates Court. She curtsied politely when the two teams met and greeted her before the hearing. Must have been the highlight of her acting stint, which did not lead to a permanent appointment. Acting Judge Saba would not have been exposed to so many grizzled advocates and so many constitutional issues in any hearing over which she had previously presided. The humour displayed by the Judge President of the Western Cape High Court, John Schlorpe, in allocating this weighty matter to an acting judge with so little experience was not lost on the legal teams. Terry's team argued that given that this was a public interest matter that would not benefit him personally, it would be inappropriate for him to bear the costs of the aborted High Court action, which he could ill afford. The President's team argued, in turn, that the usual rule should apply and that Terry, having effectively abandoned his High Court action, should be made to pay its costs. Since then, the Constitutional Court has clarified the law on this sticky issue. Following its landmark 2009 judgment in the BioWatch case, litigants seeking to advance the public interest or to assert their rights under the Bill of Rights are not required to pay the defendant's costs if their case does not succeed, provided their claims are not found to be frivolous or vexatious. Acting Judge Saba did not have the benefit of the BioWatch decision. She decided instead that the question of costs should stand over for determination after the matter had been heard in the Constitutional Court. This never happened. The President eventually abandoned his claim for costs against Terry in terms of a settlement agreement concluded between the attorneys representing both parties.